Good afternoon, and welcome to this American Bankruptcy Institute media teleconference. I am Laura Bartel, professor of law at Wayne State University Law School and resident scholar at the American Bankruptcy Institute. I will serve as moderator for this teleconference. 5 years ago, on October 17, 2005, most of the provisions of the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 2005 became effective. BAPCPA, as most bankruptcy lawyers refer to it, made the most dramatic changes to the bankruptcy code since its enactment in 1978. Today, with the benefit of 5 years of experience under the new law, we will be discussing its impact both on consumer bankruptcy and business bankruptcy. To assist us in that analysis, we have a distinguished panel of lawyers, judges, and professors. Our speakers who will be talking about consumer bankruptcy since BAPCPA are bankruptcy judge Pamela Pepper, who has served in the bankruptcy court for the Eastern District of Wisconsin since July 2005 and also hears cases in the Southern District of Illinois, Professor Catherine Porter, professor of law at the University of Iowa College of Law and currently a visiting professor at Harvard Law School, and Claire Ann Resop, a shareholder in the office of Unbreisen and Roper SC in Madison, Wisconsin, and a Chapter 7 panel trustee for the Western District of Wisconsin, as well as a member of the American Bankruptcy Institute Board of Directors. Discussing the impact of BAPCPA on business bankruptcies will be Brad Sandler, a partner with Pachulski, Stang, Zeal, and Jones LLP in Wilmington, Delaware, Annette Jarvis, a partner in Dorsey & Whitney LLP in Salt Lake City, and Brian Shaw, a member of Shaw, Gussis, Fishman, Glantz, Wolfson, and Tobin, LLC, in Chicago. To begin with a little background, one of the goals of BAPCPA was to curb abusive filings, particularly by consumer debtors who would take advantage of a Chapter 7 discharge when they could have used their future income to pay creditors over time under a Chapter 13 plan. It was thought that BAPCPA would result in an overall reduction in bankruptcy filings and a shift of consumer filings from Chapter 7 to Chapter 13. Professor Porter, has this in fact happened?
No, we certainly saw a change in filings because of the law, but we're now at the point 5 years out where we're seeing filings normalize, for lack of a better word, back to where we were prior to the enactment of the new law. So for several years, in 01, 02, 03, 04, we had filings running about 1.4, 1.5 million, and we're estimating to go to about 1.61 million filings in 2010. So the filings seem to have come back to about where they were before the enactment of the reform. It's certainly true that that change in law led to a great spike in filings up above 2 million right before the law's effective date, and then the filings then plummeted for about a year following that effective date of the law. So we definitely saw a big spike in our graph and a big spike back down, but I think now we're normalized, and I expect us to see something, barring other changes in the economy or other legal reform, I think we're going to continue to see around 1.5, 1.6 million bankruptcy filings a year.
Have they shifted from Chapter 7 to Chapter 13?
Well, it's hard. Chapter 13 varies a lot from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but looking nationally, before BAPCPA, Chapter 13s represented about 30%, a little less maybe than 30% of all filings. The percentage of cases that were Chapter 13 went up as a result of BAPCPA for the first several years, so 06, 07, but it's been steadily declining, and again, we're back now, 5 years later, to where Chapter 13 filings are roughly just under 30% of all filings.
Brian, have business filings returned to pre-BAPCPA levels as well?
Well, business filings have far exceed what was going on immediately prior to the enactment of BAPCPA, but the big difference with business filings is there wasn't the spike, and despite the changes in BAPCPA, which do have some effect on business filings. Business filings generally continue to be more affected by the state of the economy in general rather than in changes of the law. So really, I would say that, yes, they've returned. They've actually almost, you had 40,000 filings in 2005, and last year in 2009, you had 60,000 filings. They have returned and then some, but they never really declined that much because of the change in the law. Rather, it really was reflective of a good economy back in 06 and 07, and then obviously issues that arose since then have changed the economic outlook.
BAP-CIPA imposed significant new requirements on attorneys practicing bankruptcy law, particularly those representing consumer debtors. Have these requirements had any impact on the cost of bankruptcy for the debtors and for the bankruptcy system as a whole? Professor Porter?
Yeah, on the consumer side, what we've really seen is two kinds of changes. One were some additional requirements that imposed fixed costs on consumer debtors. And here I'm speaking about the requirement of credit counseling before one may file bankruptcy, the mandatory financial education in order to receive a bankruptcy discharge, and an increase in the filing fees. So those were sort of fixed costs that everybody has to incur to get into the system. And those have added to the cost, $100, $150. The other change, and the much bigger change, has been a dramatic increase in attorney's fees. And we've seen this in both Chapter 7 and Chapter 13. So there are really two good studies on this. One is conducted by Lois Lupica, funded by the ABI. And she found that, for example, the median, that is the typical Chapter 13 debtor, had direct costs, meaning attorney's fees, filing fees, of about $2,900 in before BAP-CIPA, and by 07 was up to $4,000. Similarly, data from the Consumer Bankruptcy Project's national studies show that Chapter 7 cases averaged about $985 in consumer attorney's fees, and by 07, the average attorney's fees jumped to $1,280. So we've seen substantial increases of 30 or 40 or even 50%, depending on how one does the calculation in the costs of receiving bankruptcy assistance.
Are attorney's fees going up on the business side as well, Brad?
They are. And I guess what I would say is that under BAP-CIPA, certainly bankruptcies are faster, which is causing an increase in fees. And there are additional obligations which have been imposed under BAP-CIPA. In terms of the time, the exclusive time by which the debtor had the exclusive right to file a plan and solicit acceptances was now essentially reduced from what before was ultimately an unlimited time period, because the court very liberally would extend the time period, and essentially it was unlimited. For example, United Airlines took about 3 years. Adelphia took 4 years to confirm a plan. Under BAP-CIPA, there's no longer privilege of being able to extend that time period. And now the debtor has the exclusive right to get a plan accepted within 20 months, and that's it. So that means that debtors are working much harder and much faster. In terms of other time constraints, the time period by which debtors have to review leases, commercial leases, again, that was a time period that essentially under the old law could be reviewed liberally and extended, and the courts routinely gave extensions to debtors. Now there's an outside limit of 210 days that really can't be extended. In terms of some of the additional obligations that we're seeing, which is creating a bunch of litigation, there's been a change to the old law. Debtors routinely would file key employee retention plans. And most of them were relatively simple and straightforward. Under BAPSEPA, key employee retention plans, or KERPs, are no longer allowed, and debtors now are filing key employee incentive plans. In other words, there has to be some incentive to keep the management on board. And what is an incentive versus retention is often the subject of litigation between, say, the debtor and the on the one hand, and the committee and the U.S. trustee on the other hand. We see now a new obligation, which we'll probably talk about a little bit later, but new code section 503B9 provides that suppliers of goods who delivered those goods in the ordinary course of business within 20 days of the petition date get an administrative claim. And so suppliers are now filing numerous administrative claims that need to be reviewed by counsel and need to be reviewed relatively quickly. Again, that ties into the exclusivity, the shortened exclusivity period. We're also seeing under the new code or the amendment, the committees are required to share information. And Congress didn't say what type of information needs to be shared with the constituency of these official committees. So committees now have, on a regular course, filed motions that limit their obligation to share confidential information with their constituency. And I think finally what I would say is what we're seeing more of is it's much easier to get an examiner appointed in bankruptcy cases, and we're seeing examiners appointed frequently now, certainly much more frequently than we did pre-BAPSEPA, in the Tribune, Lehman, New Century cases, and the attorney's fees for and other professional fees for the examiners are substantial, to say the least. So overall, we are seeing a substantial increase in attorney's fees. But certainly, I think a lot of that is you can point to the fact that bankruptcy cases are faster now than they were pre-BAPSEPA, and because of the new obligations or changes in the code.
Let's turn to the consumer provisions of BAPSEPA and look first at the impact of the law on the debtor. Of course, the most dramatic change for a consumer debtor was the imposition of a means test. The means test creates a presumption that a Chapter 7 filing would be an abuse if the debtor has income available over 5 years to pay non-priority unsecured claims in an amount specified by the statute. Professor Porter, has the means test really had any impact on consumer bankruptcy? I mean, after all, don't most Chapter 7 debtors pass the means test because they have insufficient income to pay general unsecured claims?
That's right. We know that most of the people who are filing our Chapter 7 cases are passing the means test. That is, a relatively the vast majority of them have incomes at the time of filing bankruptcy that are below the state median income for a household of their size. And the effect of that is, as the statute's been sort of operationalized onto forms, is that the debtor doesn't even need to explain or detail their expenses. They simply provide evidence of income. If their income is below the median income, that's it. They can proceed with their Chapter 7 case. So it's certainly right that we're not seeing a large fraction of Chapter 7 people having this presumption of abuse arising and having to sort of defeat it. What we can't measure, of course, is how many people are simply choosing either not to file bankruptcy at all or to delay a bankruptcy filing while their income changes or to voluntarily file Chapter 13 because of the means test. That is, there's a direct effect where you can see what's happening in the system, and then there's this shadow system of counseling people that it's extremely hard to measure. The 2007 Consumer Bankruptcy Project, of which I'm one of the principal investigators, we did do some analyses of how the economic financial profile of debtors has changed or hasn't changed between 2001, before the new law, and 2007, after the new law. And what we found was that, for example, household income is virtually unchanged, so that in inflation-adjusted dollars, the median household filing bankruptcy in 01 had about $27,000 in income, and in 07 had about $27,000 in income, as measured in 07 dollars. So we haven't seen a large change in the profile of who is coming into bankruptcy. These are still families with relatively low incomes, below the median, for example, often nearing the poverty line. And we've also seen these families are still coming in with overwhelming debt. One of the things that has occurred is it seems from our data that people may be delaying filing a little bit longer. So we asked a survey question about how long did you seriously struggle with your debts before you filed? And we found that in 2007, about 44% of people said they had been seriously struggling with their debts for more than 2 years. And that was a big uptick from the same question in 2001, in which it was about 32%. So I do think that there may be an effect of waiting longer, of trying harder to avoid bankruptcy, of trying other solutions. And some of that may be driven as much by the increase in attorney's fees as by the actual legal effect of the means test. The other thing I'll say about the means test is while we have it, most cases do pass, most debtors still retain the choice of Chapter 7 or Chapter 13. We have seen changes in what debtors are required to pay in Chapter 13. So the means test screens debtors between Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, but it also, for debtors who do have above median income, determines, at least in part, what they must pay their creditors. And there's been some effort to try to figure out if the means test is increased or decreased payments to both unsecured and secured creditors. And I would really say that the studies aren't fully in on that yet. My own personal view is that I very much doubt that recoveries to unsecured creditors are higher as a result of the new law. It may be that recoveries to car and mortgage creditors are somewhat higher, in part because of better recovery rights, for example, for car creditors. The other thing we've seen as a result of a means test is a lot of litigation, including several Supreme Court decisions and cases. In fact, today, the Supreme Court heard arguments in a case called Ransom versus MBNA, and it is a case about how to interpret this means test. What does it mean? And so, you know, as a professor who talks to the media about this and tries to teach their students about it, I would say, you know, the fact that we still don't know the answers to some of these fundamental questions about what BAPSIPA means and how to apply it 5 years later really speaks to the complexity of the law and how difficult it really is to interpret, how poorly drafted some of the provisions are, and how practically unworkable they've proven to be in some instances. So I would say, you know, not a lot of change in the demographic of the filer so far, but definitely an increase in complexity of the law and in administrative and attorney's fees costs.
A second major change for consumer bankruptcies under BAPSIPA has been the new requirements for financial education. An individual is no longer eligible for bankruptcy at all unless he or she has, during the 180-day period preceding filing, completed a credit counseling session from an approved nonprofit budget and credit counseling agency. In addition to be eligible for a discharge, an individual must also complete an instructional course concerning personal financial management after filing the bankruptcy petition. Professor Porter, have these requirements reduced the number of consumer bankruptcies or made future bankruptcy filings by consumers less likely?
Nobody knows the answer to that yet. It's too soon to say, and I frankly don't think that the empirical work needed to really answer that question is ever going to be done, which I view as kind of a loss. I would have liked to have seen Congress, when they impose these additional requirements, also impose that the government or the U.S. Trustee Department do a very rigorous study to figure out if they are making a difference. Most people on the ground, most attorneys and judges and trustees that I talk to, believe that the pre-bankruptcy credit counseling is ineffective. That is, the vast majority of people, when they get on the phone with a credit counselor, are told that they need to go bankrupt because their debts are you know, many multiples of their income. The financial education, I think, has more promise to be useful and to be helpful, but you know, we're not there yet. The curriculum right now, in my view, is somewhat lifted from what we might give high school seniors. I think we could do a lot more to tailor that curriculum to the particular experiences of people in bankruptcy. That is, these families have learned the hard way many of the lessons about credit, and what they really need is education about how to rebuild, how to access credit in the future, you know, what's going to be expected of them for the remainder of the bankruptcy process. So I think the financial education requirement, if not as true financial literacy, but rather maybe as education about the bankruptcy process, I think there's some potential there. It's as of yet untapped. My own view, though, is that the credit counseling requirement should be repealed.
Of course, consumer debtors were not the only constituency affected by the BAPSEPA changes. It was suggested at the time BAPSEPA was enacted that it was the result of very expensive lobbying by the banks, the auto industry, and other creditor groups. Claire Ann, has BAPSEPA been the great success for consumer creditors it was expected to be?
No, I don't think that there is any data that shows that it has been successful, that they've received any return on that money. There have been some benefits to the car lenders because of the changes requiring debtors to pay back in full loans that they have received for cars within a specified amount of time prior to the filing. But with regard to credit cards, no. And in fact, I think that some of the protections that went in for creditors, such as you can no longer sue a creditor for a preference to get money back into the estate to pay to all the creditors, although it benefits that specific creditor, it doesn't benefit the creditors as a whole who would have shared that money rather than it going to a specific creditor because of the venue requirements to be able to have the trustee get that money back to share it amongst all the creditors. And in the beginning, there was talk about pushing everybody into Chapter 13. I don't think that more creditors have been pushed into Chapter 13 in the jurisdictions because of the means test. In fact, in certain circumstances, the means test allows creditors to be in a Chapter 7 because they have a lot of secured debt, despite the fact that they're high income, and they perhaps would have been put into a Chapter 13 prior to BAPSEPA. Also, a lot of uncertainty was created by BAPSEPA because of the way that some of the provisions were written. For instance, reaffirmation agreements. There are new provisions on reaffirmation agreements on whether they have to be signed, who they have to be signed by, what requirements have to be met to do them. And when there's litigation and uncertainty, that costs everybody money, including the creditors, which makes the amount that they receive back from the bankruptcy system less.
Judge Pepper, how have the new consumer provisions of BAPSEPA affected the administration of the bankruptcy system and the role of the bankruptcy judge?
Well, I think that Professor Porter and Claire Ann both commented on a couple of issues that sort of segue into the way that this statute has impacted the court. First of all, Professor Porter talked about the fact that our filings now are up pretty much around the country to the levels that they had reached prior to the law changing. When the law first changed, our filings dropped dramatically. There was this huge surge in filings right before the law went into effect, and then filings dropped off precipitously. The filings that we did have were taking a considerable amount of time because everyone was trying to adjust to a new statute, but we had fewer of them. As time has passed and our filings have crept back up to pre-BAPSEPA levels, what we've learned the hard way is that what BAPSEPA has done is it has increased the amount of hours necessary to handle a given case. And so we have the case filings being about the same level that they were, in some cases higher, than before the law passed, and yet more time is required, not only of the courts, but I think of the lawyers and the litigants as well, per case. Some examples are, Professor Porter talked about the credit counseling course, which is required before a debtor can even file for bankruptcy. And interestingly enough, what the statute says is that a person is not even eligible to be a debtor in bankruptcy unless that person first obtains this briefing from a credit counseling agency. In the beginning, when the law first passed, we had all sorts of folks who didn't realize that this was going to be required of them, in particular, people who didn't have attorneys. And in Chapter 7 cases, we see lots and lots of litigants who don't have a lawyer. They can't afford one. They just don't have the money to hire a lawyer. So they didn't have any idea that they were supposed to be getting this credit briefing. They would file the case. There was a lot of I suppose confusion is the best word, among courts and judges. Can we even allow this case to proceed? If the law says you can't even be a debtor until you've gotten this credit briefing, and this person hasn't gotten the credit briefing, do we have to automatically dismiss the case? Do we have to wait until someone files a motion? Who's going to file that motion if the person files the motion? Over time, the constituency out there became a little bit more educated about the fact that they had to obtain this credit briefing in order to be a debtor, but then a new set of problems arose. And even today, as we sit here 5 years later, I have cases in which my docket system shows me that this person did not get a credit briefing. The case gets dismissed, and then the person, very often a person who doesn't have a lawyer, files a handwritten motion that says, but dear judge, I got it. What do you mean you don't have any evidence that I got it? I did get it. I went to this particular place, and I took this class. So we have to reopen the case to give the debtor an opportunity to come in and explain. Sometimes there's a delay between the time many of these people take these courses on computer. There's a delay between the time that they take the course and the time that they get a certificate showing that they took it, and then again between the time that they get the certificate and the time that they file it. So we've had all sorts of litigation around that, what seems to be a very simple issue, go out and get credit counseling. Claire-Anne mentioned reaffirmation hearings. A reaffirmation, of course, is where a Chapter 7 debtor says, I'm not looking to discharge this particular debt because I want to keep the item that I purchased. We see it most frequently with cars. I bought a car. I need the car to get back and forth to work. So I want to reaffirm my debt to the car creditor. And before BAP CPA, sorry, that's the Midwestern way of referring to BAP CEPA. Before BAP CPA, if a debtor had an attorney representing him or her when they were negotiating the terms of the reaffirmation agreement, the court didn't have a hearing. The only time we ever had a hearing about whether or not to approve a reaffirmation agreement was if the debtor did not have a lawyer. And the statute required us at that point in time, the pre-BAP CPA statute, required us to have a hearing to make sure that the debtor understood that, look, you're not going to get a discharge of this debt. You're still going to be obligated for it. If you miss payments, they can still come and repossess your car, things of that nature. BAP CPA changed that. BAP CPA said that if the court looked at the amount of income that a debtor reported coming in each month, and the amount of expense that the debtor reported going out each month, and it didn't look like there was enough money left over at the end of each month to allow the debtor to make the reaffirmation payment for the car or the computer or whatever it was, the court could not disapprove that reaffirmation agreement unless it first had a hearing. Doesn't matter whether the debtor has a lawyer or not. And so it is not unusual for me to conduct a hearing with a debtor who says, look, I talked about this with my lawyer, and I explained to my lawyer how I'm going to be able to make these payments. I got a raise at work, or this happened, or that happened. And yet the court now has to have hearings on these because the statute requires us to, if there's an imbalance between the amount of money that they have coming in, the amount of money that they have going out. And there are a number of these little provisions, the credit counseling, reaffirmations, the post-filing debtor education class that Professor Porter mentioned, where a debtor has to take this class, which is supposed to educate them in how to avoid bankruptcy in the future. again, many of them don't take the class, don't file the certificate, their case gets closed without a discharge, then they come back in and file a motion to reopen. I'm so sorry, I didn't realize I was supposed to do this, and now we have increased litigation. Many of us have hearings on the new provision in BAP-CEPA that requires, but says that courts can waive the filing fee for filing bankruptcy in Chapter 7 cases if the debtor reports income of less than 150% of the national poverty guideline. Many of us hold hearings in those cases to make sure that the debtor actually does qualify, because if we grant a waiver of a filing fee, then the trustee in that case does not get paid. And trustees are critical to the bankruptcy system. We couldn't function without them. Clarion's a trustee. We need the trustees to function, and we know that they don't get paid if we waive the filing fee. So we've seen not only an increase in filings, but an increase in the amount of work per case that the court and the attorneys are prepared to do. And the other aspect in which BAP-CEPA has impacted the courts and the administration of justice is one that again, Professor Porter and Clarion touched upon, and that is that there's been, I think, a somewhat fascinating level of frustration expressed by judges over the unworkability or at least unwieldiness of many provisions of BAP-CPA. When a new statute goes into effect, I suppose it's not surprising that there's litigation over it. All the attorneys are trying to figure out what this word means and what that word means and parse through the language. But what you've seen expressed among judges, and sort of a surprising number of them, I suppose, in writing quite frequently, is judges saying, you know, I can't make heads or tails out of this language, and if I go one way, it seems unfair to one party, and if I go the other way, it seems unfair to the other party, and it seems not to make sense no matter which way I go, and I'm really frustrated about that. The means test is a perfect example of that. There were a number of cases, and there continue to be, that came out in which a judge would be bound by the means test, while everyone in the courtroom acknowledged that debtor couldn't possibly make any repayments under a Chapter 13 plan if the debtor were forced into 13. And yet the means test said, but they didn't qualify to be in a 7. And the judge would sit there and say, you know, I'm not quite sure I understand how it makes sense for me to deny this person a Chapter 7 discharge. They're clearly struggling. They have a terrible, terrible time. They can't pay creditors in a Chapter 13. But this law tells me I don't have any choice but to dismiss them and tell them there's nowhere for them to go. And so you would see judges actually coming out in their written opinions and saying things like, I don't think this law makes any sense, but I don't know what to do about it, and so I therefore dismiss the case. And I thought that was pretty dramatically interesting. And as Professor Porter said, even, you know, we sit here today, 5 years after the passage or the implementation of BAP-CEPA, with a decision in front of the Supreme Court that's just now being argued on an issue that really impacts day-to-day what bankruptcy judges do and what consumer bankruptcy lawyers do.
Let's turn to the business changes implemented by BAP-CEPA. Brad, as you mentioned before, one of the major changes for business has been the new provision giving an administrative expense priority to the value of any goods sold to the debtor in the ordinary course of business and received by the debtor within 20 days prior to the bankruptcy. Why does this new administrative expense priority matter, and how has that affected business bankruptcies under BAP-CEPA?
Well, the reason why it matters is because now these claims have been elevated from what pre-BAP-CEPA would have been general unsecured claims. They're now administrative priority claims, which means to the extent that the debtor wants to get out of bankruptcy, the only way it can get out of bankruptcy is if it pays the administrative expense claims, including these 20-day claims, in full, unless they happen to agree to some other treatment, which is unusual. So that's put a severe liquidity restraint on debtors, and in particular on the large retailers. We also see from some changes, though, under Section 546, the time period by which a seller of goods could reclaim goods essentially has increased from 10 days up to out to 45 days, which is also a new change in the law. There have been some other changes too that have restrained the liquidity for debtors. The increase in the monetary limits on employee wage and pension benefit priority claims has increased. That went up from under pre-BAP SEPA. The limit was just under $5,000 for wages and pension benefits earned within 90 days prior to a filing. Under the current law, it's under $12,000. It's $11,725, which is an increase of about 140%. Again, this is an additional liquidity constraint, which has been put on debtors, and has made the exit out of bankruptcy more challenging. There have been some other liquidity constraints. If you look at the change in the code section dealing with utilities, it's yet another additional liquidity hurdle, because a debtor now, within 20 days of the filing, has to provide utilities with adequate assurance of future payment in the form of cash or some other type of security. Pre-BAP SEPA, it would be common just to give those utilities an administrative priority claim, which they now can't do. And certainly in jurisdictions like Delaware and Southern District of New York, in the larger cases, debtors are creating reserves, two-week security deposit reserves, although I've seen anywhere from 2 weeks out to 2 months, and that's per utility. And that's another tremendous liquidity restraint on a debtor, especially in the early days of a case. So we've seen under BAP SEPA, we've seen, essentially liquidity constraints aside from just the increase in administrative fees that I mentioned before, and dealing with attorneys' fees. Of course, they're administrative costs as well. But we've seen tremendous increase in the restriction on the use of liquidity for a debtor to navigate through a Chapter 11 and to exit from Chapter 11.
Now, earlier, Brad was describing that there were a number of changes made through BAP SEPA that were intended to make business bankruptcies shorter and therefore less expensive. We talked about the cost of bankruptcies after BAP SEPA. But are they, in fact, shorter? Have they been effective to change the length of business bankruptcies? Brian and Annette, would you like to comment?
Sure. From my perspective, I think Brad's analysis is correct, but it's an analysis that really applies to what bankruptcy practitioners refer to the mega cases. And the mega cases are a substantial minority, are very few of the business bankruptcy cases that are actually filed. So I think that, continuing with what Brad has said, with regard to mega cases, ultra complicated cases, I do think that it increases the top line, or increases the timeline, makes it go quicker. The assumption period in which retail bankrupts can deal with their leases is got a hard stop now. I believe it's 210 days. Exclusivity is similarly shortened, and what that does is provide that other creditors can come in and decide if they want a proposal plan. They can propose a plan, whereas while exclusivity is in place, only the debtor can file a plan. In addition, tax treatment, taxes are required to be paid now through a confirmed plan. They have to be paid within 5 years of the order for relief. And in the past, it was a longer period tied into the confirmation of the plan. All of those things hasten a bankruptcy. But the reality is that for the majority of business cases, small and even medium-sized debtors, they can't afford to be in bankruptcy that long under the best of circumstances. They try to get done in that one-and-a-half-year window regardless, and they're continuing to try to get it done. So I think the number of cases it actually affects are fairly nominal. They're just particularly high-profile cases. And to use a very current example, in those cases where they are effective, and I'll refer to the Blockbuster case, what you really have going on here is people trying to get as much significant work done at the same cost or a higher cost before the bankruptcy is filed than they would have before BAP-CEPA actually done during the bankruptcy. And in Blockbuster's case, no one in the bankruptcy community was surprised, or the real estate community was surprised that they filed. They had been undergoing a lengthy process of trying to sort through their leases and get deals done regarding as many leases as possible prior to the filing of the bankruptcy, because they knew they had this hard stop once they filed bankruptcy. And that's a practical reflection of these new laws and these new time periods on a large retail business. But mom-and-pop's business, I think there's very little effect from BAP-CEPA on the timing of their bankruptcy.
Well, I would add that I do think that these shortened periods had maybe an unintended effect on making Chapter 11s quicker, in the sense that one of the major problems businesses face in today's economy is finding financing. And the shortened exclusivity period, where the judge has no ability to extend that, the shortened period for assuming or rejecting leases affects the availability of debtor in possession financing. Without financing, a case isn't going to go on very long, because I think financiers are skittish already about lending to debtors, where they know the debtors are going to have a limited ability to control the process because of the limited exclusivity period, where they know that they only have the 210-day period to assume or reject leases. That gives very little time to make that decision, because the lenders will want to know that there's time for a going out of business sale if everything doesn't work. So that essentially shortens that time to probably 4 months within which you have to make decisions to assume or reject leases. And even smaller businesses, that's a hard process. I do think that it has driven more pre-packs, but these pre-packs really become just 363 sales, meaning just sales of assets, because these shortened timelines, and particularly in the stressed economy we are seeing today, it gives inadequate time to market, inadequate time for unsecured creditors to determine value in a bankruptcy case or to look at alternatives. And it also encourages, because of what we just talked about, the increased cost of not ever getting to a plan confirmation because of the increase in administrative expense claims that have come with BAP-CPA.
I would even add to that particularly the debtor in possession issue raised by Annette, it's also keeping people out of bankruptcy. It's just having resulting in businesses, and particularly small and medium-sized businesses, being liquidated outside of bankruptcy, and oftentimes not even in a going concern fashion, just literally picked apart and liquidated piece by piece. The other thing is that the bankruptcy code pre-BAP-CEPA gave bankruptcy judges, in my opinion, an appropriate amount of discretion, and discretion that was generally wielded well in dealing with complicated cases, and allowing those cases to have more time. So the mega cases that Brad was talking about, incredibly complex cases like the mass tort cases dealing with asbestos, the John Mansfield cases, seminal example, those cases, they warranted years in bankruptcy, because you were dealing with, and just as now, you're dealing with litigation. You're dealing with complex litigation. But you're dealing with complex litigation that is between hundreds, if not thousands or tens of thousands of parties, versus complex litigation that is, one party versus another party. And when complex litigation of one party versus another party takes 2 or 3 years, no one blinks twice. But now you're basically telling the litigants in complex bankruptcy cases that they've got to get this done in a very short period of time. And you're telling judges they have no discretion to, you know, massage that time period if the appropriate circumstances exist. And from a practitioner's standpoint, while it doesn't affect that many cases, the effect that it does have is not great.
Another area in which BAP-CEPA made changes was with respect to the avoiding powers, the powers that are given to the trustee in bankruptcy to undo certain pre-petition transactions involving the debtor. Brad, what changes did BAP-CPA make there, and how have they changed the business bankruptcy?
I think the two biggest changes that I've seen are that certainly the time period allowed under to pursue a preference has been expanded and tightened against insiders out to a year. And the second big area is with fraudulent transfers, where the reach back went from 1 year under the old law to 2 years under the current law. And certainly, you know, it's a complicated question because what we've seen in our economy over the last 5 years or so is if you go back to the mid-2000s, there was a lot of easy money, and financial institutions couldn't give money away fast enough. And certainly there were a lot of businesses out there ready, willing, and able to receive the money as the economy was steaming ahead. There were numerous transactions that would take place, LBO transactions, or just other transactions that maybe that caused companies to become over leveraged because of the easy money. And certainly with these longer time periods now, by which debtors and committees and trustees can pursue causes of action, there's been a lot of litigation. In particular, there's been a lot of fraudulent transfer litigation challenging some of these LBOs in recent years. And I think that's something that we're probably going to continue to see, over the short to medium term until we get through this. Now, whether that continues when we start getting into the next business cycle, I think that's anybody's guess. But certainly, the limitation periods, because they've been, I'll say, tightened and elongated, and because of the easy money from the mid-2000s, I think we're seeing a lot of litigation today that we would not have seen years ago.
A final area in which BAP-CEPA made significant changes on the business side was for small business debtors and debtors whose estates consist of single asset real estate. Brian, what are small business debtors and what did BAP-CEPA do to them? Did those provisions make it easier or more difficult for them to reorganize?
BAP-CEPA made it more difficult for them to reorganize. And then, of course, small businesses got the double whammy of the economy falling apart in late 07. I'm chuckling because I do a lot of small business work. And while the timeline that BAP-CEPA imposed on all businesses did not really affect the small business, the additional costs that Brad referenced earlier, additional attorney's fees, the reclamation and administrative costs, the utility issues, all of those, when piled on top of already what is an expensive process, all of those things really made Chapter 11 versus a Chapter 7, which is just a relatively quick and painful but cheap process for a business, made a Chapter 11 much more difficult to go through, to sustain itself during, or even to enter. And, you know, I sat there today. John Harkin was kind enough to pass some recent filing numbers around. And as I said earlier on the call, there's 60,000 businesses that filed for bankruptcy protection during 2009. And based on my own experience with the small businesses that we see regularly, I'm wondering what that number would have been without the changes in BEPC, because I think it would have been higher. We have seen many, many small businesses get restructured, be shut down, get sold in non-bankruptcy scenarios, so in state foreclosure actions, other type of out-of-court insolvencies, sometimes, you know, in a Chapter 7, rather than in Chapter 11, which they very well might have been before BAP-CEPA. With all of that being said, I can't give you even a guess as to how much of that is because of the increased cost of BAP-CEPA and how much of that is because of the severity of the current economic crisis, or I guess officially we're not in the recession anymore, but the economic crisis that we're sort of on the tail end of, and how much is because of that? Because, quite frankly, I don't have anything to gauge it against during my practice. It is as severe as it has ever been. But ultimately, this has been a very, very tough time for small businesses. I don't necessarily see it getting better right away, but it could be that the next business cycle sees an increase in small business filings. I was just going to say an increase in utilization.
Annette, what's a single asset real estate debtor, and what did BAP-CEPA do to them?
Well, single asset real estate debtors existed before BAP-CEPA, but there was a $4 million cap. So if they had secured claims of $4 million or less, those were the only single asset real estate cases. And BAP-CPA removed that cap so you could have very large real estate projects subject to single asset real estate rules. And a single asset real estate case is a case where the real estate involved constitutes a single project or property that generates substantially all of the gross income of the debtor and on which no other substantial business is being conducted other than the business of operating the real property. And these cases arose out of bad faith filing cases where they essentially were two creditor cases, the lender versus the owner of the real estate project, or cases where there was no hope of reorganization and bankruptcies were filed just as delay tactics to avoid foreclosure. So when these laws were enacted, what they require is you've got to file a plan with a reasonable possibility of being confirmed within a reasonable time, within 90 days after the filing of bankruptcy or 30 days after the courts determine that the case is, in fact, a single asset real estate case. And so either you file that plan or you got to commence payments to the lender. Otherwise, the lender is given relief from stay. So it would end the case. It's interesting because I think, in fact, with what's happened with the real estate debacle, in the economy, this probably has been a good thing, this change, because it does take these real estate cases, which are really dead on arrival, and moves them through very quickly through the courts so that the courts are removed of that burden. And I know there was a lot of concern that, yeah, but now you've taken the $4 million cap, so you can have these huge real estate projects that are complicated and really don't have enough time to figure out whether they can reorganize within 90 days. But the courts have very narrowly interpreted the definition of a single asset real estate case so that really it works in the sense of looking at a case or a resort. Is that a single asset real estate case? And the courts have pretty uniformly said, well, if they're operating a restaurant or a spa or something else on that, then that's not a single asset real estate case. So the way the courts have interpreted this provision, I think it's worked well.
Well, before we take questions, we'll close with just a few words from each of our speakers. BAP-CEPA was intended to prevent bankruptcy abuse and protect consumers. Has it done that? Have the changes it made in bankruptcy law and practice proven their worth in this time of financial crisis in our country, or is BAP-CEPA a law that cost much and achieved little? Judge Pepper.
Thank you. I don't know how much it cost, but anecdotally, and based on numbers that I've seen, I don't know that it's necessarily revealed or uncovered a great deal of abuse. Certainly not any that those of us who were familiar with the numbers beforehand didn't know was already out there. I don't see it as having dramatically protected consumers. And while it has given courts some tools to address those folks who are abusing the system, I'm not sure that most of them are that much better than the tools that we previously had, and in some instances, they are worse.
Professor Porter? I think we've lost Professor Porter. Claire Ann?
Yes, my concern is that we have created a system that requires an enormous amount of expense and time that is unnecessary and does not provide benefit to creditors or to debtors, and that some of those changes should be resolved for a system that works, and that the opinions of bankruptcy professionals, creditor lawyers, debtor lawyers, trustees, and judges would be valuable in resolving those issues.
Brad?
I think it's hard to know. Because of the state of the credit markets that we've gone through and are still going through, they're still tight. But what we do know is that certainly between the new 20-day administrative claims that we talked about, the additional liquidity that debtors are required to pay to utility companies, the short time that debtors have to analyze leases and to assume or reject them, the limited duration of exclusivity, the additional wage claims that we talked about, all of these have made it extremely difficult for companies to reorganize, in particular, retailers. I mean, if you look at some of the retail companies, the bigger ones, Stephen Barry's, Sharper Image, Linens and Things, Circuit City, they've all been liquidations. I think taking away the judge's discretion under BAP-CIPA in permitting enlargements of time and allowing the judge to facilitate the reorganization process, I think has certainly created increased challenges to reorganizing. The vast majority of Chapter 11s today are liquidations, whether that's because of BAP-CIPA or the state of the economy. I'm not really sure. When you do see a reorganization today, they tend to be either because the case was filed as a true prepackaged bankruptcy or pre-negotiated in any event. And maybe this means that a lot of the work that was done post-bankruptcy is being done now pre-filing. I don't think I really know. I don't think anybody really knows because of the way the economy's been. But I think it certainly is clear that we see very few reorganizations today. And most of the cases that we see are liquidations, orderly liquidations in the bankruptcy process, the Chapter 11 process.
Annette?
Well, I think conceptually, and speaking from a business bankruptcy point of view, but I think this applies to the consumer changes as well, conceptually, BAP-CIPA took away much of the discretion given to judges over many aspects of bankruptcy, including the Chapter 11 process. We've talked about the limitations, you know, on exclusivity, lease assumptions, management compensation, et cetera. And I think since the 1978 enactment of the code, one of the hallmarks of our Chapter 11 system has been its flexibility to adapt to individual business situations, to allow for maximizing value through reorganizations, through sales of business, through orderly liquidations. And at a time now when, because of the extraordinary downturn in our economy, maximum flexibility for the courts would, in my view, helped legitimate businesses to reorganize, this lessens flexibility for the courts, I think, has actually hurt our struggling businesses and our economy. When I was a law clerk at the time the Bankruptcy Code went into effect in 1979, I kept a quote from Justice Douglas taped above my desk. And Justice Douglas had been the SEC chairman in 1937 as the country was trying to recover from the Great Depression. He had a significant input into the changes in business bankruptcy law that arose out of that period. And in 1966, he authored the Bank of Marin versus England case as a Supreme Court justice in interpreting a provision of the Bankruptcy Act. And in that case, he said, and this is the quote I kept above my desk, "Yet, we do not read these statutory words with the ease of a computer. There is an overriding consideration that equitable principles govern the exercise of bankruptcy jurisdiction." Close quote. And I have faith in the discretion of the courts to assess and apply the law with the flexibility to react to individual circumstances and the facts of the case. And you add to that the increasing preferences that BAP CPA added to for certain classes of creditors, which is eating away bit by bit the equal treatment of creditors, cornerstone of the code, which is one of the basic underlying principles when it was enacted. And I think this change, the growing preferences, make it difficult for businesses to reorganize, and ultimately all creditors are hurt. So I would say the recession has shown us that, contrary to what BAP CPA did, we need flexibility back in the system. We need to give judges the discretion the code originally gave them to oversee cases, and we need to back off of giving so many special interest preferences in bankruptcy cases.
Brian?
Two things. One, to answer your question from a while ago, a small business debtor is anybody who has less than $2.19 million in debt in the aggregate. But with regard to the overall picture, I think the result of BAP-CPA was it has made Chapter 11 less accessible for the small and medium-sized businesses, and a more difficult but probably similarly accessible concept for the very large businesses. And, you know, building on something Annette said, when they enacted the code in 1978, there was a common overriding consideration back then. The entire statutory scheme was put together as a scheme, as an entire schematic response to what they perceived as problems and how to fix those problems. And unfortunately, with every set of amendments since then, and there's not just been BAP-CPA in 05, there was amendments, significant amendments in 94, earlier in the 80s. But when those amendments come in and they have the appearance of being driven by special interests that focus on one aspect of the statutory scheme versus the entire aspect of the statutory scheme, you get the problems you've heard about today, which is unintended consequences, things not playing out the way it's expected, loss of the flexibility of the entire scheme. And I think, unfortunately, that continued to happen with BAP-CPA, and because BAP-CPA was the largest in those series of amendments that I mentioned, it just happens to have the most pronounced effect.
All right. Carolyn, we would be glad to answer any questions that the media may have.
Certainly. And the question and answer session will be conducted electronically. Please press star 1 on your touchtone telephone if you have a question at this time. Once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question, and we'll pause for just a moment. Once again, please press star 1 if you have a question. And it appears we have no questions at this time.
All right. I guess we were very comprehensive. I want to thank our panelists, Judge Pamela Pepper, Professor Catherine Porter, Claire Ann Resop, Brad Sandler, Annette Jarvis, and Brian Shaw. You can follow up with any of our panelists through ABI's Public Affairs Manager, John Hartgen. For the American Bankruptcy Institute, I'm Laura Bartel, resident scholar. Thank you for joining us, and good afternoon.